Let's go ahead and open our Bibles today to the book of Jeremiah, chapter number 2, which has to do with prophecies made early on in the reign of Jehoiakim. Now, Jehoiakim is the eldest son of the late King Josiah, but he's not the first son that came to the throne after the death of Josiah. And that seems to be related into the geopolitical turmoil of this time period that we're looking at right now. In 609 BC, Josiah tried to stop Pharaoh Necho from taking his Egyptian forces north to the area around Carchemish and Haran to assist the Assyrians. And from that, we understand that Josiah was most definitely anti-Assyrian and therefore anti-Egypt, since they were Assyrians' ally. And he may have even been a little bit pro-Babylonian. So when Josiah was killed in that fight, the Judean people skipped over the eldest son and appointed son number 2, Jehoahaz, to be the king over them, a young man of 23 years of age. And that's probably because he had the same attitude as his father, anti-Assyria, anti-Egypt. Now, when Pharaoh Necho was defeated and he starts retreating back to the south, he gets word, while he's still to the north of Israel, of Judah, that it's an anti-Egyptian king that's on the throne. So he causes the arrest of Jehoahaz, and Jehoahaz is actually brought to Riblah, according to 2 Kings. And there, he is told he's no longer going to be the king of Judah. And once Necho arrives at Jerusalem, he puts the eldest son, a guy by the name of Eliakim, on the throne, changes his name to Jehoiakim, which is just the changing of the word El, meaning God, generically, to Yah, meaning he who is, specifically. And he puts this 25-year-old on the throne and then taxes Judah for what he needs to continue his military operations against the Babylonians. Now, Jehoiakim turns around and taxes the people to make up for what he had to pay to Necho. And we know that he was a bad king. He was morally bankrupt. And he's one of the reasons that Judah is sliding into their time of judgment very quickly. So Jeremiah, who is the prophet in Israel, in Judah at this time, he begins providing God's complaint, God's lawsuit against Judah for the fact that they have not kept their first love, for the fact that they have abandoned God and embraced other gods and goddesses. And from that, we can understand that Jehoahaz probably took the Judeans back into idolatry very quickly. And then his elder brother, when he becomes the king, continued that process. And so Jeremiah chapter 2, the first 13 verses that we looked at yesterday, was God's complaint that even though God had rescued them out of Egypt and took them through the wilderness and put them in a wonderful, bountiful, promised land, the Israelis had turned around and abandoned him and embraced idolatry. So let's pick it up in Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 14. Is Israel a slave? Is he a homeborn servant? Those are both intended to be rhetorical questions answered in the negative. Israel was not supposed to be a slave. He's not supposed to be some home-raised employee. He's supposed to be God's son, his firstborn child, and to act like an heir. And so because that's what should have been, but it's not, God continues. Why then has he become a prey? So if he's not a slave and he's not supposed to be a servant, he's supposed to be a son, why is it that he's getting whacked? Why is it he's getting chased down like he's some sort of rabbit? Verse 15, the lions have roared against him. They've roared loudly. They've made his land a waste. His cities are in ruins without inhabitant. Specifically thinking about what's recently happened with the Egyptians coming through, taking reprisals against Judah because of Josiah's resistance. Verse 16, moreover, the men of Memphis and Tapanhis, both of those are cities in Egypt, have shaved the crown of your head. So they've killed Josiah, and they've taken son number two, the first king after Josiah, into Egypt. So they've been shaved of their glory. Verse 17, have you not brought this upon yourself by forsaking he who is your God when he led you in the way? So isn't this what naturally happens when you abandon the covenant? Think about the book of Deuteronomy. It ends with this idea of blessings for remaining in the covenant and curses for abandoning the covenant. Verse 18, now, what do you gain by going to Egypt to drink the waters of the Nile? So that's, you know, all about Jehoiakim and how he thinks that he can get the upper hand by being subservient to the Egyptians. But the verse goes on. Or what do you gain by going to Assyria to drink the waters of the Euphrates? The Egyptians are in cahoots. They're in alliance with the Assyrians, the Nazis of the day. So what are you doing drinking out of the waters of the Nile and out of the waters of the Euphrates? What do you think you're going to gain by that? Your evil will chastise you, and your apostasy will reprove you. Know and see that it is evil and bitter for you to forsake he who is your God. The fear of me is not in you, declares he who is Adonai of the armies, of the hosts. So he who's the Lord over the armies. So this is going to backfire on you. You think that by throwing in through your king Jehoiakim with the Egyptian-Assyrian alliance that that's going to protect you, but it's not. It's going to backfire and bring judgment because you are abandoning God in the process. Verse 20, for long ago I broke your yoke and burst your bonds, but you said, I will not serve. Yes, on every high hill, under every green tree, you bowed down like a whore. Now, this is very strong language in Jeremiah, and you should take that in consideration. God brought them out of slavery in Egypt. But when they came to be the son of God, and they were supposed to serve him in love and adoration, they said, not going to do it. And instead, they gave themselves to the gods and goddesses in worship, and they acted unfaithful. Verse 21, yet I planted you a choice vine, holy of pure seed. How then have you turned degenerate and become a wild vine? A little bit of a picture in agriculture here. He had got them out of Egypt as a wine vine. And he brought them and planted them in the promised land, expecting to get good fruit from them. Instead, he ended up with a wild grape that was sour and worthless because they've turned against him. So how helpful was that? Verse 22, though you wash yourself with lye and use much soap, the stain of your guilt is still before me, declares he who is God. So you guys are filthy and dirty from your sin, from your idolatry. You can wash yourselves up as much as you want with as strong a detergent as you can find, but that's not going to clean you up. Verse 23, how can you say, I'm not unclean? I've not gone after the Baals. Some of the Israelis have probably adopted this synchronistic viewpoint that they're not really worshiping these other gods and goddesses. They're not really worshiping Baal. They're in fact just worshiping Yahweh by the name of Baal. You know, they're playing with the wording, the phrasing. And so God is not accepting that. He says, look at your way in the valley. Know what you've done. A restless young camel running here and there. A wild donkey used to the wilderness in her heat, sniffing the wind. Who can restrain her lust? None who seek her need weary themselves. In her month, they will find her. Now we go back to the animal world as another example. You've got camels or donkeys, female donkeys in particular, that is going through its heat cycle. And so it's looking for a mate. Mates don't have to force her. She is willing. And so the idea here is that the pagan nations are looking for someone to come into their orbit. And here is Judah, quite willing to jump right in there and even worship their gods and goddesses. Verse 25, keep your feet from going unshod and your throat from thirst. But you said, it's hopeless, for I've loved foreigners and after them I will go. So I can't help myself. I've got to go and do this stuff. As a thief is shamed when caught, so the house of Israel shall be shamed. They, their kings, their officials, their priests, and their prophets, who say to a tree, see, a wooden idol, you're my father. Or to a stone idol, in this time period, wooden idols very often were used in honor of Asherah, the female element of pagan worship, while the stone was representative of Baal, the male, the masculine entity of worship. So here we have the leaders, the kings, the officials, the priests, the prophets, all of them are looking to the wooden altars and they're going, you're my father. And they're looking at the stone one, you gave me birth. For they have turned their back on me and not their face. But in the time of their trouble, they say, arise and save us. So the irony is they've abandoned God to chase after Baal and Asherah and the other gods and goddesses of the Egyptians and the Assyrians. But the moment trouble happens, they start naming the name Yahweh. They start naming the name of he who is. Oh, you've got to save us. We're your people. Verse 28, but where are your gods that you made for yourself? Let them arise if they can save you in your time of trouble. For as many as your cities are your gods, O Judah. So they've got idols all over the place now. And he says, fine, you want help? Check in with your idols. Why do you contend with me? You've all transgressed against me, declares he who is. So it's as if they're bringing a lawsuit against God. You have to help us. That's the contract. And God says, why are you trying to invoke the contract of the covenant when you're the ones that have broken it? Verse 30. In vain I have struck your children. They took no correction. Your own sword devoured your prophets like a raven and lion. And you, O generation, behold the word of he who is. Have I been a wilderness to Israel or a land of thick darkness? Both of which is no. Why then do my people say, we are free, we have come no more to you? What is the deal here that you are treating me in this fashion, that you want to get out of the relationship? Verse 32, can a virgin forget her ornaments or a bride her attire? Yet my people have forgotten me days without number. Repeatedly, the relationship between God and ancient Israel was seen as a marriage. And God treated Israel with great honor and respect and clothed her in a special way and gave her lots and lots of goodies. And if you've got a relationship like that where the husband dotes on the wife, would the wife forget all the nice things that he's been doing all these years? And the answer is no, she wouldn't. And yet God says, you guys have. You guys have forgotten me repeatedly. Verse 33, how well you direct your course to seek love, so that even to wicked women you've taught your ways. Wow, that is a slam big time. Prostitutes could learn from you the tricks of the trade. Also on your skirts is found the lifeblood of the guiltless poor. You did not find them breaking in, yet in spite of all these things you say, I'm innocent. Surely his anger has turned from me. They are being unfair even against their fellow Judeans. They are cheating people and killing people in that cheating. And then they turn around and say, I didn't do anything wrong. Behold, I will bring you to judgment for saying, I've not sinned. How much you go about changing your way. You shall be put to shame by Egypt as you were put to shame by Assyria. Now, earlier on in the history, the Assyrian Empire, when it had taken northern Israel, had also caused some trouble for southern Judah. So that's the shame that's being referenced here. But now that they're kind of becoming a vassal state to Egypt under Jehoiakim, he says, you're going to be shamed by that relationship too. Verse 37, for it too will come away with your hands on your head, for he who is has rejected those in whom you trust, and you will not prosper by them. So God says, you're not going to come out of this well. It is going to be a shame. Chapter 3. If a man divorces his wife and she goes from him and becomes another man's wife, will he return to her? And the answer according to Deuteronomy chapter 24 is no, that's not allowed. When a man feels that he's been cheated on and gets rid of her, and she goes out and gets married to some other guy, and then maybe she cheats on him, and he divorces her. Old Testament law said you can't bring her back and make her your wife again. That's not appropriate. And so God is saying, is that what's going to happen here? Are you going to cheat on me and then end up getting married to somebody else and then cheat on them and then want me to take you back? Is that how you think it's going to work? Would not that land be greatly polluted? You've played the whore with many lovers, and would you return to me, declares he who is? Lift up your eyes to the bare heights and see. Where have you not been ravished? So up on the high places where altars were very often put, idols were very often placed, because, you know, it's higher, closer to heaven. He says, look around Judea, all those high places. Is there any place you didn't cheat with other gods and goddesses against me? By the waysides you've sat awaiting lovers like an Arab in the wilderness. So you've gone to the oases, the little resting spots, and built altars and had idols there, like some sort of Bedouin that travels from watering hole to watering hole. You've polluted the land with your vile whoredom, and therefore showers have been withheld, and the spring rain has not come. So one of the things that God told the Israelites in the book of Deuteronomy that he would do when they violated the covenant is that he would shut off the water. He would stop the rain cycle. And so here it is mentioned. Verse 3, yet you have the forehead of a whore. You refuse to be ashamed. This is an idiomatic expression of the idea. It's brazen-faced. Won't blush. Won't be ashamed of your action. Have you not just now called to me? My father, you're the friend of my youth. So they're in trouble. And so now they're kind of looking to God to pull them out of this difficult situation. Will he be angry forever? Will he be indignant to the end? Behold, you have spoken, but you have done all the evil that you could. So they think that all they have to do is say, oh God, please, come on, save us. And he'll jump and do what they want. And he says, no, you've got yourself into this. It's going to be bad. Now, the next part of Jeremiah we've already done because it was something from the days of Josiah. So we're going to pick up in chapter 3, verse 21, which seems to be part of this time early in Jehoiakim's reign. A voice on the bare heights is heard, the weeping and pleading of Israel's sons, because they have perverted their way. They've forgotten he who is their God. So we go back to this idea. They're in trouble, and they think, oh, maybe now we need to call out to he who is to save us. Return, O faithless sons. I will heal your faithfulness. Behold, we come to you, for you are he who is our God. Truly, the hills are a delusion, the orgies on the mountains. Truly, in he who is our God is the salvation of Israel. So there's irony that's in the midst of all of this. God really is the one that can save them. God really is the one that wants to forgive them and heal them and make them his people. And they could resort to true repentance, but instead they're doing this bouncing back and forth thing. And they get saved by God, and then they go right back into idolatry. And then they get trouble, and so they go begging God to save them, and he gives them some relief, and they go back into idolatry. And so this can't keep going on. And that's why the judgment is going to be coming soon. Verse 24, but from our youth, the shameful thing has devoured all for which our fathers labored, their flocks and their herds, their sons and their daughters. Let us lie down in our shame and let our dishonor cover us, for we have sinned against he who is our God. We and our fathers from our youth, even to this day, we've not obeyed the voice of he who is our God. So Jeremiah throws in his 2 cents worth here, that this has been going on ever since the beginning of Israel. And what really needs to happen is we need to acknowledge we're the problem. We're the ones that are in the wrong for not obeying God. And we need to take genuine repentance steps. Chapter 4. If you return, O Israel, declares he who is, to me you should return. If you remove your detestable things from my presence and do not waver, And if you swear, as he who is lives, in truth, in justice, and in righteousness, then nations shall bless themselves in him, and in him shall be shall they glory. So here's God's offer. If you genuinely repent, your actions will show that. Because you'll get rid of all this junk. You'll get rid of all this idolatry. And when you actually call upon my name and make promises in my name, then you're going to keep it. You're going to do exactly what you're supposed to do. You're going to do the just thing, the fair thing, the righteous thing. Now, what defines all that? God. He is the Holy One. He is the just one. He is the righteous one. And so Judah needs to be holy as God is holy, just as God is just, righteous as God is righteous. And if that will happen, then he can bless them. And through them, he will be able to fulfill his promise to all peoples. Remember this promise to Abraham. In your seed, in Israel, all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed in the Messiah. Have a great weekend. We'll be back in Jeremiah next week, Lord willing.